and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and my co-pilot and navigator, Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Now, Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save your money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, how are you, mate?
I'm very good, thank you. It's exciting to be here.
This is fun. I mean, look.
I know.
We've got these people.
First time in front of, and we can prove it, a live audience.
That's all right, isn't it?
I know.
I feel like I'm a radio station broadcaster.
It's good, isn't it? No, it's genuinely very exciting. And thank you to all of you for actually coming and supporting our maiden voyage of Fueling Around Live. And what a show we have for you tonight.
And indeed, our special guests today on this very special live edition are quite simply touring car legends. You know them both, like me. You know what, where this might end up.
Absolutely. Right. Some of you know the story, some of you don't. But for those that don't, I would imagine that it will be... What are you doing? Jason? So you're putting that on because you're hoping
Because I'm safe with this on.
Okay, fine.
Because he's a black belt in some sort of jiu-jitsu karate type thing.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage our very special guests, touring car legends, Mr. Tim Harvey and Mr. Matt Neal.
Mate, I took my glasses off to put my helmet on and then I couldn't read my script. Could you not?
Is that why you've put me in the middle?
Yes.
The referee.
You're the peacekeeper. Both of you, thank you so much for being here tonight. It's a real privilege and a pleasure to have you with us.
Yeah, it's great. And with Tim in the middle, it's at least he pads it out a bit. So,
look, from a man that couldn't afford to buy a pair of socks, I don't know what you're talking about.
I got up early this morning. I forgot them.
No socks on.
I have got socks on.
Isn't it?
Well, clearly.
Who saw Tim at the barbecue earlier? Because you know what his nickname is.
Do you know what? I had to stay away from that because whenever I go near food, someone will stick a camera in there and it's going to come out in a book. There's going to be a book of Tim's eating. I actually forgot to bring my biscuits out with me from the green room over there. But
his nickname is the Buffet Slayer.
Hashtag never knowingly underfed.
So listen, we want to sort of do what is a normal episode of the podcast with you here live with our select invited audience. So I think we want to do what we normally do, Jason, which is start from the beginning in terms of the car history. It's where we normally start off, isn't it? I mean, before even motorsport, where did the love of cars come from? Tim, for you, I mean, what was the first kind of vivid car memories that you have as a child?
Well, for me, it's really easy. My parents were not professionally involved in motorsport whatsoever.
Was it your first car, a Model T Ford?
I've only just started. No, it wasn't black and white Model T Fords. But my parents were... My dad was a surveyor, but he was passionate about cars. And he always had a collection of cars. He managed to find work for various motoring people. And his payment was usually borrowing a car of some sort. So, and then at the weekends, there'd be like a picnic in the back of a Mini or a Lotus Cortina, and we'd go off and do a sprint or an autocross, and he'd meet up with all his friends, and we kids would run around and, you know, get into trouble and things. But so motorsport as a sport was always in the family sort of recreation time. It was very much part of it. He was always working on cars in the garage and tinkering away, and so that's where the love of it came from.
And yourself, Matt? I mean, what was the first sort of got you hooked, if you like, presumably as a very young child?
My dad bought me a little go-kart, just motorized lawnmower thing when I was about 4 years old, and that got me hooked. I just loved it. I mean, it's the days before mountain bikes or BMX bikes, and so we used to build things, whether it be you mount your bike, you rode down the road, or and you lived outside. There was no video games or none of this sort of stuff. And then sort of it progressed, and I never did karting or anything. You know, I never started racing till I was 17, and that was on bikes. But I seemed to, when my parents, I had an elder sister, so my parents used to go away and leave us when I was 12 years old, 12 and 13 years old, which you wouldn't hear of nowadays. And I can remember borrowing the keys to the cars. My mum had a beautiful... 3 Series BMW with all martini stripes down it, borrowing it and going down the local when I was 13 years old, coming out, and I think, right, I've seen this on TV, I've seen it, you know, I'll get the back end out, spinning it, pirouetting down the high street and managing not to hit anything, which is slightly better than you managed, isn't it? I think.
isn't it amazing that you've nicked your mum and dad's car when you were 13 and so did I?
We've all done it. Yeah, we've great. All done it. Unfortunately, I found my mum coming back from the shops the other way. And she said, you wait till your father gets home. He actually thought it was very funny. So I got away with it. But yeah,
I was caught. The first time I was caught, was we had a black LT28 Volkswagen van, which we used to go around in karting. And Dad was out of work. I can't remember where my mum was. She was the nurse at the time. She might have been on day hours. But we had a little tiny front garden. We had the gardener there, and I'd convinced him it was fine for a 13-year-old to go out in a van because I had a special race license. I could drive anything. and he bought this, and then I got back and then drove around the corner and saw my old man's car parked outside. And all I remember is winding down the window, and then something came out of Dad's mouth, but I can't remember what it was, and then I ended up on the grass. and then I remember the gardener said, oh, no, it's not his fault. He's got a special license. My old man knocked him out. Yeah, so I didn't do that again.
No.
Until the next week, and we managed to get my mum's car off the driveway while she was asleep.
So there's a common theme then, obviously, that sort of connects you all in that respect.
So how old were you, Matt, when you first remember your dad racing?
My dad retired. The only time I can remember my dad racing was about the time he retired, and I think I was about 2 years old, okay. 1 or 2 years old, and he'd done a race at Nürburgring and had a big accident down the Dottenhohe, hit a tree, and he was all in, his arm was here, and he got patches over his eyes, and like I remember as a two-year-old, these guys brought him back from Germany, literally, because my mum would have gone ballistic, and they just propped him against the front door and legged it.
Left him.
And left it. And I can remember him coming in, and they lay him on the bed, and I'm, as a two-year-old, just stood at the end of the bed, just looking at him going. And that's the only memory I've got of my dad racing. And then he did a celebrity race at the British Grand Prix at Brands in 1976, and they were all in escorts, and he did that.
I was in it. No, I wasn't.
and I remember that because we sat in the grandstand up at turn one. So those are the only two memories I've got.
How did he do?
He was doing all right. No, he spun off.
Oh.
We've spoken a lot, actually, on the podcast series about... There's a very magical moment, I think, isn't there, when you finally pass your test.
First get your licence.
Can you still remember that day now in terms of like what it meant to you?
It meant I could go out and try and drive a car at 100 miles an hour. That was my absolute goal. And there was a hill. I lived in Kent, and there was a hill down the hill towards Tunbridge. And I thought, if I get... Because I only had a grotty little car.
What car was it?
It was actually a Hillman Avenger Estate.
Nice.
Yeah, absolutely horrendous. I actually went through two of them because... One, the first one, I put in a roundabout near Brands Hatch in a village called Otford, and I put it in the duck pond. Actually went straight on into the duck pond. I've misjudged my braking on a wet night. And the second one actually went into a house behind Brands Hatch opposite the Rising Sun pub. But that was black ice. Was not my fault. All right. But I remember thinking when I passed my test, I just want to do 100 miles an hour. So I took the car out.
That was the target, the big target.
That was the target, just do 100 miles an hour. I thought that would make a man of me or something. Anyway, so I took it to this hill there and I got it up to 100 miles an hour. And that was my biggest moment, yeah.
And yours, Matt, do you remember your first seminal moment in a car?
I don't remember my... I remember the test, because I failed the first time, but all best drivers passed the second time.
Same here.
Oh. And
passed third time lucky.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't remember. It was really surreal that you're going to drive on your own after that. So, but yeah, it's just freedom, isn't it? But the guy I used to hang around with, my mate at the time, he was like 21, so I was just driving everywhere with L plates on. Anyway, we were going out and going everywhere, and I was just driving as a learner.
So car history then, we've already had brief mention, Tim, of the Hillman Avenger.
Hillman Avenger Estates.
Okay.
Rural.
Estates.
Yeah. Why go for a second one after you've had the first one?
They were cheap. Yeah, they were really cheap. But the second one was, I worked for a builder in Longfield just behind Brands Hatch. I was going to work on a February morning, like 7:30. And the road from Brands Hatch, from Scratchers Lane to the right, you go down the road and there's a left-hand bend with a pub on your left, the Rising Sun, which was our local. And as I went round the corner, literally water had run down the hill overnight and frozen across the road. And I skidded across the road and I went straight into the side of this house, literally put the front of the car through into the kitchen. The last thing I remember was the jack whistling past my ear. And when I came round, I was being dragged out of the car by the owner of the house. Not surprisingly, I'd ruined his cornflakes. And he was telling me that he was a taxi driver. He'd never had an accident in 35 years. I must have been driving too fast, which I thought was pretty bloody obvious. You know, otherwise we'd have crashed. But there's a car wrecking place on Scratchers Lane. And we literally dragged the car up the hill and left it there. And that was the end of that. And so I was carless, and I've been looking at this car in Longfield that belonged to the guy that ran the auto paint factors, and it was a Mark 1 RS 2000, white with a big blue stripe down the side. Oh, nice. I mean, that was my ultimate car. And I sort of said to my dad, I would really love that car, thinking, having just written off to Hillman Avenger, I thought, there's not a hope in hell I'm ever going to get this car. And he basically said, look, if you work and do this and pay me back and all the rest of it, I'll help you buy the car. Right. I couldn't believe it. And we bought this car, and I honestly, that's the car I learned to drive in. Yeah. I thought I was Hannu Mikkola or Ari Vatanen in this car. I mean, they only had like 100 horsepower. They weren't quick, but leaf spring suspension, you know, you'd slide it around doing 50 mile an hour. And I swear I learned to drive in that car. I can't believe I got it.
What about you, Matt? What was the early car history? What was the first car? What was the first and second?
First car was a Mark 1 950 Ford Fiesta Popular Plus Maroon.
Yeah.
It was great. I burnt the clutch out in about 6 months doing rapid starts and everything. But like your things, I remember, again, my dad was away, and I managed to have 7 accidents in 1 week.
It's like Craig David.
Carried on and went into touring cars then.
I set myself up perfectly. And they weren't all my fault. Like, the dog ran out on me and I sort of hit that at speed at about 60 mile an hour. And then I sort of went a bit further down there, ran in the back of someone else. And then someone drove in the door. And then I borrowed one of the works vans. And then something happened in that. I went over ripped the front wheel off it. And then I borrowed another one of the works vans and I hit a tree in that. It didn't go down very well, so I got through cars quite rapidly.
Sounds vaguely familiar with my journey through cars, because I've had a few whacks.
Well, that just sounds like some kind of elaborate Hollywood car chase, what you've just described.
Well, I always
there.
Think you learn by your mistakes, don't you?
And you had a very concentrated
week. My pièce de résistance with it, though, I found this car in the newspaper, because it was before the internet and all that, and a Golf Mark 1, no, Mark 2 Golf. My dad said I'd saved up enough money because I was working at the time. I was about 19. And he says, right, I'll take you to go and pick it up. And we met this guy in a car park, paid the money. And I'm following my dad back. And we pull off this island. He hits the brakes and he's got an M5 BMW. The brakes on an M5 BMW are a lot better than in a Mark 2 Golf. I'll just put this out there at this point.
In the back of it.
I buried this car in the back of his M5.
Couldn't you imagine?
And he got out of the car. He didn't come to me. He went because there was a lamppost within 10 feet of where he got out of the car. My passing memory was him watching him just, my father beating his head on the lamppost. It was at that point I knew I was destined for touring cars.
how can I make this into a profession?
Unbelievable, eh?
He didn't speak to me for a while after that one.
Well, I crashed the car, having caught my mum and dad up to no good.
Tell us about that.
Similar sort of story. I'd convinced my dad, I was working for him at the time, selling insurance, and I'd convinced him that it would be a good investment to get one of these Lancia Integrales with a right-hand drive conversion with 300 horsepower. And I managed to catch him at the right time when he was really drunk, and he kind of agreed that that would be a sensible company car. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I had this about 3 weeks, and
It was about 7 o'clock at night, and I just couldn't work out where they were. So I'm walking through the house, and I happened to walk into the bedroom and saw some stuff, which I wish I hadn't seen, and it scarred me. And the only thing I could think about doing was getting in the car and going for a blast. And my head wasn't fully on the job.
Unlike
the old man. And I went off and hit a tree and wrote it off. Oh. But the worst thing was I then had to call him up and disturb him again to get him to come and collect me. And he said, "But just drive it back." I said, it's not drivable, Dad. So then he was like... No! So that journey back wasn't... It was an unusual journey, Dad.
Matt, was there a moment in your car history where you kind of thought, yes, I've arrived, in so much as, you know, you've obviously earned some money through the racing and whatnot. What was your first car that you were really proud of, would you say?
First car that I really... road car that I really loved. I got a E30 M3 limited edition, which I wish I'd kept. Yeah. I'll just put that out there as well. A friend of mine dealt in cars. He got it really cheap. It was a snatchback or something. Anyway, it was a beautiful car with no mileage on it. And I kept it. It was left-hand drive. I just loved it. And that's when I thought of bright red. I'd arrived with that. And loved that. Sold it too cheap, about $9,000. Because that's all they were worth back then.
Yeah.
Now they're 10 times that.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
That was your my RS2000 moment for you,
I think, same sort of thing.
100%. So that was your moment, the RS?
I'll tell you, the RS2000, I actually sold that to buy my first wife's engagement ring. Big mistake.
Oh.
Big mistake. And close your ears, ladies, but gents, don't ever make that mistake again, because it won't pay off in the long run. If I kept the RS2000 and not the first wife, it would have been worth incredibly more to me, both sentimentally and financially. So,
right, I'm going to write that down, actually. Yeah. Make a note of that.
Jason, what was yours? What was the first car that you sort of thought, right, you know, I've arrived,
well,
I've made it?
The first car which I truly loved was a 1.9 205 GTI Peugeot. That was the first one. And that was great. But I guess probably, the iconic car which, you know, when I was a kid, I promised myself, or I made a bet with myself, that I wanted a Ferrari before I was 30. And I just... didn't quite make it. Although, interestingly enough, everyone in motorsport thought I was still 29, which I wasn't. I managed to nick a year. And interestingly enough, on my 30th, which I thought the team believed, Williams believed it was my 29th, they'd obviously seen my passport and some of the European trips we'd done away testing, and they took an advert out, a full-page advert, a double-page spread in Autosport, and they'd found a picture of me looking, you know, a little bit confused. And they said, "This man needs some help. He can't remember his birthday. Happy 30th. So they knew all along. But I guess that, you know, I managed to find a 355 Ferrari in Germany just after I was 30th. And that was, you know, I loved that car. That was great.
Is that the one I left a note
on? Oh, that is a great story. this is a mint story.
So Jason's got his Ferrari with his P180 Plato plate on the back. So I see it parked up in Oxford one night, and I thought, right, I'll have a bit of a laugh here. So I got pen and paper, and I wrote this message and stuck it under his windscreen. And the message read, "Jason, I think you're really hot. I would do anything for you. Please call me, and we can hook up." And I left my number. But obviously, in those days, you didn't know who they were. Anyway, I thought, we'll just see. Anyway, he calls me and says, "Hello."
I think, you blonker.
This is good. He thought he was on a dead cert,
well,
didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah, but I didn't go all the way.
Wait, I'd forgot that. Yeah.
So that was mine.
Very, very good. I think we need to get onto the elephant in the room to an extent and talk about the touring car days.
I've got a big nose, but behave yourself.
We obviously alluded to it on the way out. It's well documented that Matt, your relationship with Jason, your relationship with Matt, has not been the smoothest over the years.
I think it's just been tremendous rivalry there, hasn't it?
Sure, but I'm going to cross over to our independent adjudicator, Mr. Tim Harvey. Tim, you were obviously there at the time. What did you make of the feud, if you like? Is that the right word? Was it whipped up by the press? Was it real? What was your take on it?
Well, if you're referring to the specific event at Rockingham, I was actually saying, hit him, hit him! I wanted it all to kick off.
Do you know
off.
The funniest thing was? That's what I was saying to him.
Yeah.
I was going, hit me, because I knew if he did, he'd be in a right load of trouble.
Yeah, exactly. look, okay, I'm going to try and take a neutral's point. I think it's very easy to find reasons to dislike your competitors because they're your biggest rivals. You don't want to really like the person that you're racing with. Away from it all, we all can get on. I mean, I used to have this hate relationship with John Clellan. I still have. But it's very easy to find reasons to dislike your competitors. Mm-hmm. And I think, you two guys were naturally together on track a lot. You were very close rivals. It's almost impossible to be mates at that point, isn't it? And so it didn't come as a surprise. But a lot of it comes from passion and emotion and from heat of the moment. It's not a lasting thing. It comes from that heat of the moment.
Absolutely. And also, I think, both Matt and myself realised that it was actually, until it boiled over, it was good for us. We were the focal of the championship, the focal point. And actually, we kind of juiced it up a little bit. But do you remember when Gow called us in, Alan Gow, the series boss, and said, look, guys, can you just cool it down a bit? And we looked at him like, what? This is great, surely. Do you remember?
Yeah, but the other thing is, obviously this has been highlighted. Me and you have been highlighted, but I've fell out with loads of other people as well. Reedy, Jimmy.
Now we know what the common denominator is.
No.
Likewise.
Ivan, Alain. Yeah. You can... was pretty much
everybody
at some point. I was goading Reedy to hit me in one of the podiums one day because I knew that I was trying to get him into trouble, just pushing the right buttons. But I think we go about things a different way, but we're very similar.
Yeah,
and we're both quite mischievous. So he would do something to me just to get under my skin because he thought it was funny.
Yeah,
and obviously I'd take it the wrong way, and then a month later, I'd see an opportunity and I'd do something to him which I thought was hilarious to get under his skin. Yeah. And he'd get the ache about it, which I thought was brilliant. And this just sort of snowballed until it got a little bit out of control.
Do you remember Mondello when there'd been a kickoff in qualifying or something and we'd got the upper hand and I think Matt's team had kicked off. So I sent the lads out late on the Saturday night to go to a mother care and get a little pram and load of toys. And first thing in the morning, we tipped them over and put all the toys out of the pram and left them outside their garage and had like a film crew out there waiting for them to open it. That went down like a ton of shit, let me tell you. But it was funny. Do you know what I mean?
I did deposit the bucket and spade back and said, you will need this to dig yourself out the gravel later. But
there's been some good, funny moments over the years. But it hasn't all been edgy.
I was going to say, but how does a feud, for want of a better word, or a rivalry, how does that happen between two people as opposed to, because obviously when you're all raiding, you were saying obviously that you had a sort of long-term fallout with Clelland. How does it become specific to one particular person when everybody is effectively trying to do everything that they possibly can to get them and the car in front of someone else on the track? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But don't forget, you're always... I mean, part of racing is the psychological battle.
Right.
I mean, it is absolutely part of it. And you're trying to get under your nearest competitor's skin. You're not bothered about the people at the back of the grid. But if you can somehow get under the skin of your nearest competitor, he's thinking about that and the argument you had or the fact you left gravel in his shoe or something, anything, then he's just... It's taking an edge a little bit away from his concentration on racing. And that's why you do it. And when you get two people who always want to have the last word, then it just never stops. Yeah. And you see reason to keep going on. But yeah, I think both, I mean, with Clelland and myself, we both also realised at the time it was actually quite good for touring car racing. You know, touring car racing has always had characters. And, to be a character, you've got to be outspoken, haven't you? You've got to say something. So it's good for the sport and it was good for the for trying to get an edge over the other person.
Jason is one of the few, he's the only time I've begged them to put points on my own license. I've been in front of the clerk of the court. So I'm going, no, I want the points. Give me the points. And we've been in a race. We were in a race at Snetterton. And it was, you used to accrue the points back then. It's like a road license.
So 12 points and you're out.
3 points for a standard misdemeanor. You're up to 12. Your license comes back to the MSA. You're banned for at least one race. And they wouldn't tell us how many points each of us had got on our licenses because they knew we'd all twig onto this. But we all knew he was on 9 points. And he was leading and I was second. And he started brake checking me all the time. And we're going around Coram and he brake checked me. I just missed him. On about the fourth time, he really slams his foot on the brakes to sort of compromise me. And I nudge into the back of him, nudge him wide. And I think, well, I've got to go through. And so I go through. And then the last corner, I get this whack in the back. Obviously, he's a bit fired up because I've nudged him and I've gone through. And we both go off. So we both compromise. I think we finished fifth and eighth or something. So we compromised ourselves. But then they haul up because you were driving for MG at the time, I think.
No, Seat.
Was it Seat? And anyway, I get hauled up for the initial hit. And they're saying, yeah, you've done this. You've caused this off. And we're going to do you 3 points. And I said, okay, no problem. But we've always told us in all the briefings, retaliation is twice as worse as the event itself. So give me my points, and then you've got to give him points too. And I could see their faces, and they went, right, everyone out. 20 minutes later, we walk back in. They sit us down. Right, you two, you've got to calm things down. I'm going, no, give me the... I want the points.
I'm fascinated to know, obviously, we know that you had your... differences and your fallouts and whatnot, and we've all seen the footage of Rockingham. Where was the moment where that relationship was mended? Did it come about from having not seen each other for a while and then suddenly you did, or what was the moment where suddenly you realised, actually, do you know what, this is nonsense, should we just get on and become the friends that you are now?
Is it mended? Well,
do you know what, I'm just thinking that moment hasn't, you know.
Has it never really happened?
Well,
is it
not as, you know, a bell's rang and a moment's happened. But, you know, we, you know, for the last God knows how many years, 4 or 5 years, we've not really been at the sharp end of the track together, scrapping it out. And I think had we have done, then there's every chance we wouldn't be
tonight. Wouldn't have happened.
But I think it's just evolved. You know, I'm a bit older. Matt's a bit older. You just mellow out a bit, and you know, I think. The older you get, you can actually look at yourself in the mirror and go, you were a bit of a twat there, weren't you, JP? And I think Matt's probably had those same sorts of things.
I look in the mirror and go, I think you're a bit of a twat.
But is that in many ways excused or explained through age, in as much as can you see it happening again? I mean, Tim, obviously you're commentating week upon week. Can you see that kind of... Yeah, I mean, with the current crop of drivers, can you see...
I thought you were going to say with these two, well, but possibly. To be honest, it would only take one altercation on track for it all to come out again, wouldn't it? I mean, it wouldn't take much.
No, I think one of the turning points was we were at Donington or somewhere and we had a good hard race, you know, for the podium position, and we gave each other space and fairness and all the rest of it. And that was a bit of a light bulb moment, and I thought, I can trust him. Mm. And then I went on, and then I know if I do get a hit him. We talked about this earlier, didn't we? If I get a hit off him, I know he means it.
Yeah.
And it'll be for a reason, or it's probably because I've given him one, or vice versa. When some of the current crop, I actually don't know whether they mean to do it, but they just, it happens because whether they run out of whatever.
I'm bound to say this, but I genuinely believe this, and so does Matt. You know, we got a terrible reputation. And actually, it's not right. And the reason it's not right is all this stuff was going on all the way down through the pack at a much greater extent. Mm. But the TV cameras weren't on them. They weren't interested. So we got this reputation of being really hard and aggressive. But actually, other than a few moments in time, the racing has been very hard, but genuinely sensible.
Yeah, but that doesn't make the story, though, does it? So obviously they highlight on the...
What's actually happened, and you said it yourselves, in the last few years, you haven't been competing against each other in the same way. Yeah. And that's because touring cars has changed. Back when this was all going off, every weekend, the two of you would be at the front. Every weekend. It was a given. Yeah. So you'd be fighting for the wins, and you'd always be on track together. Now, with
25 cars covered by a second in qualifying, you might have four or five cars between you and never see each other. And that, and you're not always up the front with reverse grids, with ballast. It's a different set of regulations. Mm. So you're not guaranteed to be racing against Absolutely. Each other each time.
But I Sadly. Fancy another bingle, don't you? Should we have another? Oh, it'd be great, wouldn't it?
Well, ultimately, it's a sort of compliment and a sign of respect, because if you didn't care enough to either try and depose or get an advantage over that person, it's because you rate them. You know, it's because you know that they're good. You know, and obviously Jason knew you were good and you knew Jason was good and obviously you knew Clelan was good and vice versa.
I was just in a good car, as he kept on telling me.
But you know what I mean? Ultimately, it actually boils down to a sign of respect, really, doesn't it? Because if you didn't rate them, you wouldn't even be bothered. You wouldn't give them the time of day.
Look, every driver on the grid respects the other top competitors.
Yeah, but
you may not say it because you don't want to give credit to somebody, but yeah, everybody respects them. You might race them slightly differently because of their traits,
yeah,
but you do respect them all. But yeah, you're just still looking to get an advantage if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there is no doubt, you know, you mentioned the age thing. I think the older you get, you do, you know, you turn off that intense competitive almost mindset, and you start to understand that actually, you know what, I do respect him. I would never have said that years ago, even to myself. But actually, as you get older,
yeah, Tim, you're painting me and JP badly, but
here we go.
Perfect, ladies and gentlemen. He wasn't called the smiling assassin for no reason. I remember a particular thing at Snetterton with a headlight.
Did that happen?
Yeah.
Do you want to show out the story, or do you want to refer to? Yeah, I mean, actual fact, the smiling assassin thing was written by Paul Radisic in his autobiography, and he was talking about his time with me at Peugeot, and he said, "Oh, Tim," he mentioned in his book, he said he referred to me as the smiling assassin, and when my wife read that, she was really upset. She said, well, "What does he mean? What does he mean?
That's is not this the first wife or the second wife?"
Yeah, the current Mrs. Harvey. Yeah, and she said, "That's not very nice, is it? That's not very fair." And I said, "Well, it's actually true, isn't it? That's what you do. You smile on the outside, but you're trying to stab him in the back underneath and get the best engine or whatever it might be." I said, "That's actually quite good. I'll take that as a sign of a compliment, really." The grease on the camera lens story.
Yes.
Right, okay, so what happened was, this is in 95 when I was driving for Volvo, run by Tom Walkinshaw, and onboard cameras were being used all of a sudden for judicial guidance rather than just observers' reports. They were being used. And very often there'd be one camera shot and the clerk would seize upon that and say, right, you're in the wrong, look at this. Nowadays, there's four or five different angles and you get a better viewpoint of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But in those days, there were quite a few bad calls, shall we just say, on things. And Tom Walkinshaw came to the race at Snetterton. Whenever Tom came, it changed the whole atmosphere in the team. Everybody was on fear mode, you know, just treading on eggshells. And we'd had an issue a few races before where a judicial had gone against us. And he said, well, we'll fix that. So he said, right, we're going to put some grease on the forward camera, which was in the front bumper of the Volvo. But he didn't do it in a very subtle way. So what happened was, there's the mechanic who had grease on his hand. When they went to push the car back into position on the grid, he sort of walked up to the camera and sort of went like that. And of course, the camera was already on.
It was live streaming.
It was already on.
So you've got footage being captured live.
It wasn't going out live. It was being recorded on the in-car camera. Yeah. And after the race, because it was being edited at that point, it wasn't live, and they were looking through all the cameras at BHP, Barry Hinchcliffe, and somebody saw this camera and thought, that's a bit odd, so looked into it a bit further, and then they heard some audio from me to one of the guys leaning into the car saying, have you put grease on the camera?
No.
And then by sheer misfortune, I happened to take Alan Menu off in the race.
Was it Menu or Rydell?
Rydell was my teammate at Volvo. And I took
Menu off,
who was a championship rival of Rydell's.
There we go. See?
So then all the shit hits the fan. So then Alan Gow is sort of calling me up and saying, thinking I was totally complicit in all this, and I'm thinking this is not going to go well. So he said, look, somebody's got to put their hand up and take responsibility for this. So I rang Roger Silman, who was the team boss at TWR, and I said, look, Roger, we've got a problem here. Alan's on the warpath. He wants to see us all before next race at Alton Park. He said, as long as somebody puts their hands up, admits it, it'll all be washed under the carpet. So we go to Alton Park, we sit in his bus, it's 2 hours before qualifying, and he says, right, who's taking responsibility for this? And Roger puts his hand, he says, Alan, I have to take responsibility. Tom came along, it was a silly idea, blah, 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 blah. So Alan says, right, in that case, here's a piece of paper, you are officially banned from this championship. Volvo are banned now from the championship unless you pay £10,000 before qualifying. Okay,
right.
Yeah, absolutely. So manufacturer team, you can imagine. I mean, so Roger has to walk out, call Tom and say, this is what's happened.
10 grand.
And we've got to pay the 10 grand. And that is a true story.
All happens in the BTCC, see? Yeah.
Were you two fined at all? I mean, for your misdemeanours?
Well, in fact, we discussed this earlier. It was £2,000 each, wasn't it?
On that occasion.
Did you have a sort of accumulator thing going on?
Yeah, which I thought we got fined at... But the mad thing was, it's one of the times we got frog marched straight from the... past the clerk of the course, straight to the stewards. And as soon as you get in front of the stewards, you know it's going to start getting expensive. Or a bit heated. And we sat there and they stick the finger as, you're meant to be a... responsible members, your people are looking up to you, young drivers, you're going, right, you can have £2,000 fine, you can have... Within 100 feet of walking out the steward's office, the ITV guys are there saying, lads, that's great, can you do it again next week? And we're going, but I actually took that, as I mentioned earlier, as a win-win, because the team paid my fine. So I thought, I've had £2,000 out of Jason's pocket. So that was a win-win to me.
Team paid all my fines as well.
And I was just glad at Volvo that I didn't have to pay anything. I walked up, thought, yeah, I had a result there.
Here's a question for you. Was it true that in your Volvo contract, there was a very strange clause in there?
There was. Nobody will believe it, Jason.
No, well, that's
they
why,
will
that,
not
that's
believe
why
it.
I'm
my
it there.
Contract with TWR said that I had to weigh 80 kilos with all my kit on, because 80 kilos was the maximum driver ballast at that time. Any more than that was, a penalty. So it said if I weighed more than 80 kilos, I wouldn't get paid.
Is that true?
That is
honestly
true. And you know they used to do the weigh-in at the media day? Yeah. They used to do, they used to do it at the race weekend. First race, everybody go in the garage, be weighed. And a week before, we had a media day, and they suddenly said, we're weighing you now. And I said, well, I'm not ready. I've got a few more kilos to lose. And I was 83 kilos, because I thought, well, last minute, go for a run, go for a cycle with a sweatshirt.
Get food poisoning.
Yeah, something, I'll lose it. And so I was 3 kilos over. And I thought, Tom saw it and I said, oh, do you want me to turn up at the weekend then? And he said, yes, laddie, but you won't get paid if you're over 80 kilos.
Is that what really?
Absolutely true, yeah. Wouldn't believe it now, would you?
but Tom was nice because he bought you a nice flight back from Australia, didn't he, on the one Bathurst?
Yeah, look, there are lots of stories about Tom. There are lots of stories about good and bad. What I will say about him is, I mean, I always had a good relationship with him, as most people did around the paddock as drivers and things. You know, he was a competitor and you had a good relationship. He'd always talk to you. The moment you worked for him, it was a totally different thing. That whole running his operation on fear was completely different. His attitude to everybody was get everybody on their toes, get everybody performing by pressure and fear. And he completely changed his attitude towards me. Yeah. I have to say, subsequently, he was back to the Tom that he was before. But I got invited out in 89 to Bathurst for the 2-litre race to drive one of the S40 Volvos. And there was a huge crash on oil in the race. And myself and Greg Murphy and 3 other cars went off just going into the dipper on oil. And I went straight into the concrete wall because Greg went in first and removed all the tyres, so I hit the bloody wall and shortened this Volvo considerably. And it was one of those dead stop thumps where you just go oof, inside and you everything hurts immediately and you're like, right, have I broken anything? You know, you're winded and everything else. Anyway, I crawled out up onto the bank and Greg Murphy said, you don't look so good, mate. And I'm like, oh, right. Anyway, I got carted off to the Bathurst Memorial Hospital and... Forgive me, gents, you'll understand. Ladies, not so much. But I'd basically twisted my nuts, okay, on the crutch strap. And the doctor said, well, we can give you a general anaesthetic or we can perform a manual... I said, yes, now. Now. Anyway.
Manual on twisting.
Yes. Right. And so things got resolved. And but I was getting married 7 days later.
Is it
to
is
wife
it?
Number two? Number two. I've only had two. It isn't a long list. Number two. 7 days later, and Tom, bless him, he I mean, bearing in mind that car had been sold to Jim Richards to race in 2 litre out there, and it was completely trashed. They actually, true Aussie style, they brought it back on a forklift truck at the end. Here's your car, mate, and it was absolutely stuffed. So Tom had suffered. Some loss in this, but he upgraded my flight to first class to make me more comfortable on the way home, and I thought, yeah, top bloke. The end of that story is that I walked down the aisle 7 days later looking like John Wayne with all my mates laughing, saying, have a good honeymoon, Tim. Yeah.
Back to the road then, I think, just a couple of quick fire ones before we wrap up. Tim, you are allowed to have one car and one car only from all of those that you have owned for the rest of your days. Which one is it and why?
Race car or road car?
Road car.
Oh, God, that's a really difficult one. I think I would have to say I'm currently the proud owner of a GT3 RS 991. And I don't think they make a better naturally aspirated car. And if they're going to go away because of EVs or whatever we choose, I don't think I could keep a finer car than that.
It's a good choice. Matt, for you?
I'm a bit more of a practical man. I'm, like Jason, I've had Porsches, Ferraris, I had a Honda NSX, you know, in the last couple of years. One of the new hybrid ones, which is a fabulous piece of kit. But the boss of Honda a few years ago sat me and Gordon down over a pub meal and he said, right, if you could have one car, be given free of charge, but you've got to drive it every day for the rest of your life, what would you have? We both looked at each other and went, a Range Rover.
Really?
And he went, why? And he said, well, you chuck all your stuff in the back, it's comfy, it's this, it's that. But I've never owned a Range Rover. So I have had a few BMW X5s and it would probably be BMW, Mr. Practical, I like... chucking my junk in.
You see, you wouldn't go for an RS6 or something where you can get everything in the back and you can still do stupid speed?
No.
No?
I'm quite slow on the road. I'm quite slow-ish. I've got it out of my system.
You're not getting the answers you wanted, are you, Dave?
No. Listen,
I came up with something sexy.
Listen, I'm just curious. On that point, sorry, to all three of you, I guess, is that when your living is racing... and going as fast as you possibly can in a motor car, does that to a certain extent take that edge off it in terms of what you want to do on the road? In other words, your whole life is so concentrated, does it therefore take away from the fact that you don't want to be nailing it off that roundabout or, you know, you want to sort of drive in comfort and...
If I think it makes you calmer, and now I am 100% calmer. If people are cutting me up and I just go after you, or people sound off and I just laugh at them, but you do have a switch point. I do have a switch point where I will...
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that.
There's some guy about, I don't know, 10 years ago, and I went... He thought I'd cut him up the island. I didn't think I had. So I waved and say sorry and everything. So he tailgated me down to the next dual carriageway, and I got my wife and my little baby in the car, so I didn't want any problem. And then he came past, and I was just calm. And anyway, he came past, give me a certain sign out the window, which Jason's given to me, and that was the switch point.
Was it like the Nescafe one where they magic the beans?
It was a bit of a switch point, but it ended up with an X5 buried in the back of his car.
Did you?
Yeah. He didn't do it again.
Well, also, I'd imagine that when you stand out at 6'6", and, you know, if he knows that you're a martial arts black belt, then that would dissuade him from cutting you up ever again.
Yeah, I did end up in custody giving statements at that point. But, yeah, It's another story.
Look, I've never had to go to custody. I've always escaped. but I think the thing is that, you know, generally, you know, driving on the road, even if you drive a little bit quickly, is nothing like racing because you're still leaving a massive safety margin.
Yeah.
And when people say, oh, they drive fast on the road, what they mean is they take more risk. They're not actually driving the car as fast it will go.
Yeah.
If a racing driver in any road car actually drives it as fast as that will go and starts judging things by millimetres and inches, it's so unlike anything else on the road that you just can't do it.
Yeah.
So you can never replicate on the road what you do on the track because you just can't. But yeah, we all, I think, have driven probably faster than we should, certainly in our youth.
We have a mad moment every
but,
now and then.
You know, you can't do that anymore.
No. I mean, when I first had kids, that's when it turned for me. That was the switch of just calming down on the road. Because I probably was way too quick. And now I just have a mad moment every other couple of hours.
Days.
Yeah.
On that note, Jason, I think you need to take us out.
That's about it for this very special live edition of Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Thank you to you, Dave, as always, but a huge thanks to our special guests this week, the legends that are Tim Harvey and my old mate, Matt Neal.
Superb, thank you very much. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plater or at David Vitti. And if you like what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button, and share the podcast on all your socials.
And lastly, a big thanks to you guys and girls. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.